Okay, so today I want to look at the Middle Ages. Yeah, the Middle Ages, je vous rappelle les règles, vous êtes obligé de prendre des notes, à moins de faire semblant d'avoir un bras cassé. Okay, the Middle Ages. Now, the Middle Ages, on dit en français le Moyen-Âge, c'est pas très descriptif. Hein. Le Moyen-Âge, c'est des moyens. Hein. On n'a pas trop aimé, c'est des moyens. The Middle Ages, so... Nobody is, there is no exact date when the Middle Ages begin or end, but it's this idea after the end of the Roman Empire and before the Renaissance. The Renaissance, if you remember, is the rediscovery of classical science, Archimedes and Plato and all this. Which is connected to the revolt against the total power of the church. So, really then the Middle Ages began already last week. That was already a little bit the Middle Ages. But I'm going to talk about the Middle Ages from the Norman invasion, 1066, yeah, the last time that England was invaded. So it's a long time ago. Yeah, I was very young at the time. And the Norman invasion of 1066 for the next 400 years. So I'm going to talk about 400 years in 1 hour. Yeah, so it's very rapid. But I hope to give you some idea of the main dynamics, the main things that which were happening. So first of all, of course, William, vous dites en français, Guillaume le Conquérant, yeah, William the Conqueror, comes over to England and is successful. He defeats King Harold, who is there in England. So the first question we might ask is, why does he win? Why is he successful? Because his army has only 6,000 people, 6,000 soldiers. It's not like modern war. Yeah, war in the Middle Ages is not like modern war. It's not millions of soldiers. It's 10,000 here, 10,000 there. And most of the population is not terribly affected by wars. Most of the population, we must pay more tax because there's a war. But it's absolutely not like modern war, the First World War, the Second World War, when the entire population is implicated. Absolutely not. Many people didn't know there was a war on. Yeah, remember, no newspapers, no television, no radio. Oh, the war's finished. Oh, yes, it finished last year. Oh, that's good. Yeah, so very, very slow communications. William conquered England then with 6,000 soldiers. The reason they won is fundamentally they were better soldiers, they were more professional soldiers. And many of them were, yeah, they were not particularly Norman nationalists. They were, a lot of them were mercenaries. A lot of them were mercenaries. They were fighting for money. Yeah, it's a job. Yeah, the life is hard. You've got to have a job. And so they were fighting, a lot of them, for that reason. Also, remember, at the time, the armies are not professional like today. During a battle, if your side is losing, after the battle, you join the other side. You change armies. You know, very intelligent people. Yeah, it's not similar to modern war. Okay, so after the invasion by the Normans, the French-speaking aristocracy are the rulers of all England. Yes, so they speak French. The ordinary people speak English, and the aristocracy speak French. Yeah, and that's how it works for hundreds of years. And they introduce a new system of law, a new legal system, a very Norman idea. And the Norman idea is that all of the land in the country belongs to the king. Everything belongs to the king. And it is given on trust. It is lent to the aristocrats. Yeah. Okay. So you are the Duchess of Yorkshire, and I'm the king. Pourquoi pas, c'est bon, chef. And this land is mine, but you can have it, you can use it. But of course, I want something in return. So this is the Norman conception. Is the king is the proprietor of all the land and gives it on trust in return for services to the, of course, not to the ladies, to the men of the aristocracy. The Normans were very impressive architects. They built castles, very important when you're having a war. They built castles and fortresses which are still standing today. Yeah, half of the Tower of London was built in 1066, the Tower of London, yes? And several other ones as well. Now, what did the king? Let's start with the king. What was it like being a king at the time? Not similar to being Queen Elizabeth II today. Yeah, Queen Elizabeth II, her main job is to do this. Yes, hello. At the time, it was a little bit harder work to be a king. The king moved around the country all the time, constant movements to reinforce loyalty and to reinforce links with the local people. Yes, this is the Duke of Leeds at the back. So when I go to Leeds, of course, he has to feed me and all my 1,000 servants. And in return, I will give him some favours, make some laws, etc., etc. And every year, the king gives three big parties. We don't say parties, we say feasts. And these are very important to solidify the aristocracy. Of course, William's problem, and the problem for many of the kings, is if you are king because you won a battle, this is a problem, because you might lose the next battle. And so he has to be very careful to, all the kings have to be very careful not to allow a revolt by some section of the aristocracy who have a better idea as to who should be king. For example, when the king gives land to somebody, he will give you one farm in Yorkshire, one farm in the south of England, one farm in the west. Yeah, I'm a king, I will never give a lot of land in the same region to one person, because I don't want a geographical base for a possible revolt. And if every one of the aristocracy has a bit of land here, a bit of land there, a bit of land there, it's difficult for them to organise an army to destroy me. Yeah, so it's you know, you have to watch your back. Yeah, c'est pire qu'être comédien. Les autres, il y a un sentiment de concurrence. Now, one of the wonderful things about this period is the Doomsday Book. Ça c'est D-O-M-E-S-D-A-Y. The Doomsday Book, because the king decides, William decides, he needs a survey, of all the land of England. Who lives where? Who has a lot of money? Who has a lot of sheep? Who has a lot of cows? And they write, he organises the accountants to write a huge number of volumes with great detail of how many people live here, how rich are they, what taxes do they pay. Now, the reason he does this is he wants to know how much tax is possible to collect, how much tax he can collect. But for the historian, it's a wonderful book, because for most countries, for Italy, France, Germany, at this time, we have very little information. We're guessing. We think this was the situation, but we don't know. But for Britain, we have this big book, every village, almost every village, is listed with the approximate number of people. And so this is the Doomsday Book. Very, very useful. And we find out, for example, that already in 1086, there are approximately the same number of towns and villages as 800 years later. Yeah, so basically, all of the land is settled. They are small villages and small towns, but after this, you don't get a lot of new towns and new settlements. All of the best land is occupied. Yeah. Now, oh my God. This is the Middle Ages. Okay, all of the best land is already occupied in 1086. However, of course, the agriculture is not very efficient. There are many things they do not know about how to grow food. And the same farm in 1086, 500 years later, can grow much more food. Much more food. And of course today, much more food. Yeah, the production is much, much higher. In this period then, All of the best land is occupied, and so what they do in the 12th and the 13th century, non, non, vous n'oubliez pas les maths et tout ça, le 12e siècle, c'est 1100 et quelques, oui, n'oubliez pas. Je sais qu'il y a des gens qui oublient. The main advance of agriculture in the 12th and 13th century was the reclaiming of marshes. They took over marshes, donc les marais, la meilleure terre était déjà prise. Alors on en était à récupérer, à convertir des marais et des forêts. Now, that was the 12th and the 13th century, that's what was happening. Now, so the Doomsday Book did all these calculations. Very difficult to do calculations. This is the 11th century. There are no Arabic numbers. Yeah, les chiffres arabes, on ne connaît pas. Yes, it's still the Roman numbers. Yeah, yeah, M, C, M, blah, blah, blah. Yeah, very complicated for calculations. Not a good system, the Roman system, for calculations. And so what did they do? They used the abacus. You know, you have this square frame with 10 balls on each one, and you do it. If you're good, you can be very fast. Je sais qu'on dit parfois en français le boulier chinois, mais ça existait un peu partout. C'est peut-être l'origine chinoise, je n'ai aucune idée. Yes, that's how they did the calculations for the Doomsday Book. This was the level of technology. Okay, so let's have a look then at the king's servants, and we can get an idea about the life of some of the people at the time. For example, the most important servant of the king, a bit like a minister, was the king's chancellor, and he was paid every day. He received 5 shillings, 1 best quality loaf, and 2 ordinary loaves, 1 measure of best wine, and 1 measure of ordinary wine, 1 wax candle, and 40 candle ends. 40 bouts de chandelle. Okay, this was his salary. Okay. Now, this is very, very strange for us today. If you went for a job at McDonald's and they said, oh, well, this is what we're giving you. Sounds a bit bizarre. This is very typical of medieval society. Money is not the most important thing because, of course, there are very, very few shops. So money, you know, it's much more important to have the things you need for every day. A lot of the economy is... You must work the land for the king, no money, but in return you can work this land for you. So a lot of the economy does not have money in it. And this period, the 11th, 12th, 13th, 14th, 15th century, is very slowly the rise of money. Yeah? The decline, very slowly, the decline of traditional services. Yeah, I am a knight and so I must... 4 days every month I must work for the king in his army, but my peasants must work for me on my farm for 17 days every 3 months. You know, very, very complex service system, which is, from a purely economic point of view, not very efficient. Yeah. And this is the big change, because the Middle Ages is the time before the dictatorship of money. In the Middle Ages, the most important thing you have to have is land. You are rich if you have land. And the change from this system, which we call the feudal system, to the modern system, where what matters is money, is this very, very slow process. The king had a lot of servants, and every servant had a very specific job. For example, there was a servant whose job was to dry the king's clothes. Okay, qu'est-ce que vous faites comme boulot? Alors je sèche le linge de Sa Majesté. C'est cool comme boulot quand même. Okay, this is quite funny actually. Another servant had to organize the king's bath every month. Okay, yeah. This is another thing. It's true that the hygiene, well, they did not understand that it was necessary. And of course, so they were often very, very ill. There were also, of course, many people who needed to collect food for the king, hunting especially. Yeah, hunting. You go out and hunt rabbits, deer, etc. Because you cannot go to Picard and buy the surgelé. There were no surgelé, no Picard. Yeah, or in England we have Iceland. So they had to go hunting. Of course, a lot of the ordinary population did not have enough to eat. And the rich people ate very badly. from a nutritional point of view, very often they ate meat and no vegetables. Too much meat, I mean really too much meat, because meat was prestigious. And this is very bad for your health, you know, to just eat meat. Other things were very difficult to get as well. Salt. Salt was expensive. Also, salt is extremely important. Why? Why is salt so important? There were no fridges, absolutely. Yeah. Salt, if you take meat and you salt, you put salt, a lot of salt on the meat, it will last for 6 months. Yeah. And so it replaces the fridge. Yeah. Well, it didn't replace the fridge because they didn't have an idea of a fridge, but you know what I mean. Pepper, extremely expensive. Sugar. Sugar was a rare luxury for the king, although honey was relatively easy to get hold of. Okay, so that's the kind of life of the king and his court. And of course, religion, very, very important. Now the Christianity is established, and every aristocrat's household, the big houses, the castles belonging to the aristocrats, everyone had a chapel. Yeah, you must have a chapel. And if you're lucky, a priest of your very own. Yeah, your very own priest. Yeah, I know you're jealous. Now, this was relatively stable, but there were wars in Wales and in Scotland. You know, the Norman domination of England had problems in the north and problems in the west, as usual. And I have some pictures about this.
En fait, j'ai pas eu le temps d'organiser les photos, alors je vais faire des allers-retours.
Yeah, this is Conwy Castle. It doesn't matter. The name doesn't matter. This is a castle in Wales, and this is built not very many. 1283. Yeah, 1283. So this is a little later, the 13th century. This is the castle which they built. Now it doesn't look too impressive. Mais il a duré 800 ans, hein? C'est correct, comme architecture. This is Conwy Castle. You can see this is the medieval system with these little slits to fire your arrows through. Yeah, and of course, when the enemy tried to climb up the walls, you pour boiling oil on their heads. It's very amusing. It's very amusing indeed. This is in Wales. I have another one in Wales soon. Dover Castle. Sorry, I'm not in order here. There you go. Two more. This is also in Wales. This is earlier, 1093. This is an early one, 11th century castle. Again, in good condition for the age it has. And this is, of course, to when the Norman kings managed to dominate Wales, they had to build castles to keep their domination, because the Welsh were not so happy. There were a lot of revolts. Of the Welsh. And one more, my favourite one. This is Rutland Castle. This is Rutland Castle in Wales. You can still visit them today. My father took me here when I was 9. Okay, a long time ago, but not as long ago as this castle. Okay. Also, from the point of view of religion, this is the period of the cathedrals. Let's see if I can find them. Voilà. York Minster. This is one of the biggest cathedrals in Europe. The other one, which is just as big, is Cologne, Cologne. And the other one is Seville, in the south of Spain. But York, this is York, and this was built, this was begun in 1080. Yeah, mil catalan, they began it. Now, if you look at this, even today, this would take a lot of workers, a lot of time. And if you imagine with the technology of the time, it's extremely impressive what they managed to do. And fundamentally what happens is that the ordinary people from the villages and the towns, they come to York, and this building, what does it say? It says, the church is powerful, you better obey us. And you look at it and say, okay, you're powerful, that's good. Yeah. Also from the point of view of technology, when you go inside the church, you see two great technological inventions. One, a clock. You have never seen a clock. Okay, there's one in the church. And two, an organ. Yeah. So the two of the most impressive technology you will ever see are in the cathedral, in the church. So it's all part of the domination of religion at the time. Now, if I get my notes back, I will be able to continue. So, first instability is on the borders, Wales and Scotland, but also in 1169, there are revolts against the Normans in Yorkshire, in Cheshire, so in the north of England, not Scotland, in the north of England. Revolts, yeah, it's an unstable situation. It's relatively stable, but there are revolts. And also, the aristocracy is sometimes a little worried about the absolute power of the king. And so you get a conflict where they try to oblige the king to follow some rules. And and this document is one of the important stages in that process. This is a page from the Magna Carta, which is a document the king was obliged to sign, King John was obliged to sign in 1215, the beginning of the 13th century. And basically it says, I am the king, I accept that I must follow the law. This is a new idea. This is a new idea. Yes, the old idea is, I am the law. What's the problem? Yeah. And in particular, the Magna Carta introduces some very influential ideas. For example, if you are accused of a crime, you may be tried by a jury. Le tout début des procès avec des jurés, which is quite important, yes. Things like that, and things like that. Those are the most important things. And this document, some of the sections of this document will be used again in the American Revolution, in the French Revolution, and so on. It's a fairly early situation. One of the most significant sections of the Magna Carta was clause number 61. And clause number 61 established a committee of 25 barons, 25 aristocrats, who could, if necessary, contradict the king and veto the decisions of the king. So the king was not so happy with this, but the king was obliged to sign it. He signed it, but then he did not follow what he promised to do. That's life. Never trust a king. The result of this was, a few years later, a civil war, which we call the First Barons' War, which is to try to reorganise the power in the country, fundamentally between a section of the aristocrats and the king. Yeah, so this is the instability of the situation. At the end, the king was obliged to make some concessions. One of the concessions, for example, was to begin to organise meetings of the aristocrats and the bishops to advise the king. This is the very beginning of the idea of parliaments, When you're studying history, in particular British history, you must be very careful with the idea parliaments. Because today, although we don't think the Parliament is so wonderful, we think, oh, Parliament, that's democracy. Yeah. This is true after 1884. But before, in the Middle Ages, Parliament is absolutely not concerned with democracy. None of the elites are democratic. It's simply that the aristocrats as a group are defended in Parliament, and sometimes the church as a group and other rich merchants as a group, but nobody thinks that the ordinary people should be influencing Parliament. That's a very, very modern idea. Well, some people think it, but they don't have any power. So, and I think I have a picture of this. Sorry about the order of all this. Yes, this is a 11th century, donc c'est avant 1100, an 11th century picture. Ils voulaient en faire un CD, mais ils n'avaient pas encore la technologie. And it's a picture of the king and his council, the king and the people who are looking to him. Yes, they're looking to him. Now, they look rather unusual, don't they? Some of them look like women. I don't think they are. I think they're all men. And there you have the king in the middle with a very, very, very big sword. Okay, the symbolism is not difficult. Okay, everybody looking at him. So this is actually from the time. This is a picture from the time. Okay, so that's the king and the power of the king and so on. Let's have a look at the aristocrats, or in particular then the barons and the knights. You know, chevaliers, because this is the period of the knights, although of course most of the stories about knights are just stories. It's just like the origin of the United States is not the same as the Westerns. They're just stories, okay? So what was the reality of the knights? Well, very often, if you were the younger son of a baron, yeah, the eldest son will become a baron, and the younger son will become a knight. And if you are a knight, then you have to fight. I will explain in a moment where you fight and when you fight. Some of the knights married English women. Remember, the aristocracy is French, but some of the knights begin to marry English women, and there is a mix in there. And the king will give the knights some land in exchange for military service. And as I mentioned before, they prefer to give a little land here, a little land there, and not one big group. Now, one of the great pastimes of the knights was the tournaments, les tournois, you know, just like in the films, you know. You know, you get on a horse with a long lance and you go. It's worse than video games, yeah. Now, many people were killed in the tournaments, yeah. It's not quite as violent as the Roman gladiators, but nevertheless, a lot of people were killed in tournaments, you know. It was less violent, but nevertheless. Now, the church, the Pope, quite often denounced the tournaments and said, no, this is not a good way for Christian knights to pass their time. And in particular, the Pope did not want them to spend all their time on tournaments because the Pope wanted them to do something else, which was, of course, the Crusades, les croisades. This is the period of the Crusades, which is an attempt by Christian kings and the Pope to take Palestine from the Muslims. Yes, okay. This is the occupation of the time. So the popes would often ban the tournaments. Yeah, they would say, you know, anybody who takes part in this tournament is no longer part of the church. But it was not very effective because people loved the tournaments. These tournaments were taken very, very seriously. At this time, the traditions from France, the customs from France of the coat of arms arrived in England. Je pense qu'on dit en français le blason. Vous savez tous ces blasons super compliqués avec trois lions à droite et pas la même couleur que la famille à côté. All of this tradition, which was taken extremely seriously, was introduced into England at this time. And the knights, the fighting, became more sophisticated because the armor became stronger and much heavier. And if you have heavy armor, you need better horses. Yeah, and better horses are more expensive. So there was all this process going on. If you were a knight, you had a particular series of duties towards the king. At the beginning of this period, to be a knight was a privilege. But later on, really, the duties of the knights became too difficult. Nobody wanted to be a knight anymore. And in fact, the king declared, at one point, the king declares, I think I even have the date here. No. At one point, the king declares, all men who have more money than this amount must become knights. So it's no longer a privilege. It's an obligation. Yeah, you must be a knight because I said so. Let's have a look at taxes then, les impôts. Tax is always extremely important in any society, but remember the aim of the Romans was to get tax from the places that they occupied. Very often the tax was not money. Very often the tax was sheep or corn or other things. And what we get in this period is, again, as part of the rise of the money economy, we get the rise of scutage. S-C-U-T-A-G-E, scutage. Which is very, very simple. If you are a knight, instead of doing your military service for the king, you give him money. Okay, and this becomes institutionalized. Yeah, you're a knight. Oh, but I don't want to go and fight in the Crusades. I like it here. You know, okay, well, give me the money then. Yeah, that's the tax system. Very, very important. And so this is part of the rise of the money economy. The rise of the money economy. And we will see in a moment that also, little by little, the people who work on the Lord's land for the Lord, little by little, they will be paid in money. And the people who have land of their own, which the Lord gives them in exchange for service, little by little, they will have to pay rent, money rent. So everything is becoming money, very, very slowly. The total process is 500 years or more. Very, very slowly. But money is a rising thing here. Let's have a look at the countryside and the forests, because at the time, of course, we have countryside in England. Today in England, there is not really much of a countryside. When you go out of one town, 20 minutes later, you arrive at the next town. It's not like France. France is empty in comparison with Britain. Of course, there are other places like, you know, Mali, which are even more empty. But England is very, very full of towns today. Not Scotland. Scotland is different, but England is very full of towns. At this time, then, a lot of the forests, well, the forests are disappearing little by little, but they're still very big forests. But they are changing. First of all, the animals are changing. You don't find wolves anymore. It's quite interesting if you take traditional stories which come from Germany, really. Little Red Riding Hood, Le Petit Chapeau Rouge, and all the other stories about the wolves. Well, at this period, the wolves are disappearing. Yeah, the wolves are disappearing in England, and later they will disappear in Germany and France. Also, the wild boar are disappearing. Obélix, il ne serait pas content, parce que tous les sangliers sont en train de disparaître en Angleterre à cette époque. Now, of course, the forests are very useful for ordinary people, because you can find rabbits and wood, honey and deer. The forests officially belong to the king, and he establishes special forest tribunals to try to stop people from taking things from the forests, animals, honey and so on. Sometimes the punishments are very cruel. Yes, cut pieces off your body, and if you take deer from the king's forest, you can be hung, executed. There are many folk music songs about this. Of course, many people continued to steal from the king's forest. It was like a national sport, but it was better not to be caught. The king was hoping, in fact the kings were hoping, to protect the forest. But in the long term this was impossible, because the agriculture, if you destroy the forest and make agriculture, you can have a lot more food for the same area. So the period of agriculture was in, the forests were going away. The plow, la charrue, was extremely important. So you have this period where there is a competition for land. We need more land. Most of the best land is gone. So let us try to find a way to persuade the king to let the local lord have more of the forest and destroy the forest and make agricultural land instead. We also have the very beginning of the process called enclosures. You will hear more about this extremely important idea, enclosures, on the français, les enclotures. It's a technical term. What does it mean? Very, very simple. Whole sections of the land, the hills, for example, who do they belong to? They belong to everybody. And the enclosures at this time, and the enclosures are a new law which says this part of the land, which was common land before, which belonged to everybody before, now it belongs to her or him. Yeah, it's privatization of common land. The king gives this land to his friends in exchange for services. And this process will continue for centuries and will be a terrible, terrible suffering for the ordinary peasants, because they will lose all this common land where they could have a few sheep, get free wood for the fire, and so on. In the village, the system used is the system I mentioned last week, the open field system, where you have a strip here and a strip there and a strip there, and you have a strip here. Strips, yeah, the long, narrow pieces of land. Just wide enough for a plough team, for eight oxen. Yeah, eight oxen, yeah, the animals who pull the plough. A group of eight oxen with a big plow and charrue derrière. And this is the situation at the time. The technology is getting better. But it is very difficult to find food in the winter. Difficult to have food in the winter. Partly because they do not know of winter vegetables. Turnips and Swedes. Le navet et le rutabaga. These are vegetables which I detest, which they made me eat when I was a child. But at this time they were very, very good because they grow in the winter, and they allow you either to survive the winter or to feed the animals, so that it's not necessary to kill almost all your animals in October. So this is what's happening. Now, it's not really a very good time to live. It's not a very comfortable time to live. But the population is rising. Obviously, we do not have precise statistics for the population. There are many things we do not know. So this is very approximate. In the 11th century, 2 million. In the 14th century, 5 million. Now, this is very approximate. Même on devrait dire qu'en fait les historiens devinent. It's really not precise at all. But there is a depth. What is absolutely certain is there is a rise. Now, rise is good. This means either the agriculture is better or the medicine is better. It's not the medicine. The medicine is not better. Okay. It's still medicine at this time is still magic. It might work. Normally it doesn't work. But occasionally it works by accident, yeah? It's like, no, that's politics. Okay, so what's the situation? When you are born, you have a little baby. Life expectancy at birth, espérance de vie à la naissance, 31. 31, life expectancy at birth. However, if your little child gets to 10 years old, that's the most difficult bit, the first 10 years. And life expectancy at 10... Donc, si vous arrivez à l'âge de 10 ans, le plus probable, c'est que vous arriverez à 42. Do you see what I mean? That at birth, life expectancy is 31, but a lot of the deaths are for little children. Okay? And if you arrive to the age of 30, you will probably live to be 52, which is very, very old, I'm sure you agree. Okay, right. So the main danger was to die when you were a young child. That's the main danger. Second main danger, most of the work was manual or hunting. It's dangerous. But the really bad news for some of you is that there was something which was more dangerous than manual labour and more dangerous than hunting. Do you know what the activity was which was more dangerous? Mm-hmm. More dangerous than hunting, more dangerous than war at this time. Mm-hmm. Yes, having babies. Having babies. The number of women who died when they had a baby was absolutely massive. And so, at this time, between the age of 14 and the age of 40, entre 14 et 40 ans, les femmes mouraient plus qu'une femme. Okay? Because remember, the normal thing to do is to have 20 babies because 7 will die. So you have a lot of babies and it's very, very dangerous, okay? Not today, but they said the Middle Ages, okay? And this is one of the reasons, it's very logical, really. It was very popular at the time for some women, to say, oh, I think I will become a nun. It was safer. It was really, a lot of women were terrified of the idea of having babies, because people were dying all the time, you know. And so the best thing to do was to become a nun, which was, you know, why not? Okay, so we're now moving towards the end of this period, and I want to talk to you a little bit about the 14th century. Life in the 14th century, so 1300 something. And the first thing I'd like to mention is the Black Death. La peste, the Black Death. 1348, 1348, c'est pas la seule fois qu'il est venu, hein, il est venu quelques siècles plus tard aussi, but 1348 was a big, big attack of the Black Death, and across Europe, 25 million people died, we think. 25 million. Okay? C'est pire que la grippe, hein? That is to say, approximately 30% of the population across Europe. It's an absolute massive catastrophe, the Black Death. Just everywhere. In Britain, again, we do not have exact statistics. We don't know. It could be 20%. It could be 40%. We don't know. It was a lot. A lot of people. Okay, and it will come again in later centuries. A few centuries later, in the 17th century, we have it again, but this is this particular 14th century Black Death. And the immediate economic effect was there was a labour shortage. There were not enough workers for the farms. What happens when there are not enough workers? Economically. That's the agricultural problem, but what happens to the economy? Say again?
Crisis,
yes. What's the good side of it?
They are able to keep the money for all themselves.
No. C'est l'augmentation des salaires. It's logical, yeah? Yeah, the Lord, I need people to work on my farm. So, well, he needs people, and he needs people, and he needs people. Who shall I work for? How much will you give me? Yeah? When you have not enough workers, wages increase. Normal, like everything else. Quand il y a pas assez de bananes, les bananes sont plus chères aussi. Okay, right. The government was, the king was very worried about this, and so in 1351, donc trois ans après la Grande Peste, he issues a law called the Statute of Laborers, the Statut des Travailleurs, which says, which tries to limit the increase in wages. And this is probably the first time in history that the government passes a law about wages. Okay? Here I have a little section of the law here. Because a great part of the people, and especially the workmen and servants, have lately died in the pestilence, many, seeing the necessity of masters and the great scarcity of servants, will not serve unless they may receive excessive wages. Donc c'est marqué. Puisqu'une grande partie du peuple, et particulièrement les ouvriers et les servants, sont morts récemment à cause de la peste, il y en a beaucoup qui voient que les maîtres sont dans les besoins et qu'il y a un manque de serviteurs, qui refusent de servir, sauf s'ils reçoivent des salaires excessifs. Excessif is a matter of opinion, of course. Yes. So this was one of the results of the Black Death was the shortage of labourers and therefore the rise in wages. intervention of the government to limit the rise in wages. Yes, and one of the results of this was sometime later the big peasants' revolt of 1381. 1381, a very important revolt of peasants against taxes. The poll tax, it was called. It was called the poll tax because it was the same tax for everybody. And it was too much, and so they organized a revolt. And this revolt began in the way that revolts usually begin. In one village, they refused to pay the tax. And threw the tax collector in the river. And then one village, two villages, five villages, 10 villages, social explosion. The rebels from Kent and from Essex decide to go to London. They break open a prison and they release a man called John Ball, who is a radical priest. I will talk to you about him in a minute. Then they go to London. They attack the Tower of London. They take the Tower of London. They find the Archbishop of Canterbury. They execute the Archbishop of Canterbury. This is a real revolt. Yeah? This is not a little revolt. This is a big revolt. They execute the Archbishop of Canterbury, and they destroy a number of buildings connected to the rich. The king is obliged to negotiate. Now, the king is only 14 years old, okay, so it's mostly his friend. It's mostly his friends who negotiate. But when the leader of the rebels goes to negotiate with the king, he is killed by the servants of the king. Okay? I told you never to trust the king. And there you go. And the revolt is crushed. Okay? Really, it was very difficult for them to win. You know, the peasants probably could not win. But certainly they terrified the king and the next Archbishop of Canterbury. Now, at this time, if you have a social revolt, of course, the vocabulary of the social revolt is religious. I think I mentioned this last week, and I will certainly mention it next week. In this period, religion and politics is the same thing. And if you want to understand religion and politics separately, do not study the Middle Ages. It is impossible. Because at this period, everybody believes that God controls the world. And so if I say, I want a different religion, it means I want a different society. And if I say, I want a different society, it means I want a different religion. So the leaders of this peasants' revolt were very interested in John Ball, B-A-2-L, pas le bon ethologue, mais le prêtre radical. Je vous dis ça parce qu'il y avait une petite anecdote un peu rigolo, j'avais... Dans l'examen de première année, c'était qui était John Ball, c'est ce prêtre radical dont je vais vous parler. Et il y avait une copie qui dit c'est un ornithologue célèbre du XVIIIe siècle. Je cherche sur internet, effectivement, il y a un autre John Ball qui est l'ornithologue du XVIIIe siècle. Bon, résultat, quelqu'un qui ne sait pas très bien utiliser l'internet a quand même réussi avec son iPhone à chercher. C'est la seule possibilité, personne ne connaît cet ornithologue. Quoi. Et c'était rigolo. Voilà. Et ça n'a pas marché pour lui. OK. Right. So, this John Ball had a radical idea of religion. He said the most important thing is the Bible, not the church. The most important thing is the Bible. And in particular, a very famous quotation from John Ball, when Adam Delf and Eva span, what was then the gentleman? Quand Adam creusit la terre, et Ève tissait les vêtements, ils étaient où les aristos à cette époque-là? So a very radical idea. Let's look in the Bible. Remember, people believe the detail of the Bible. People believe the Bible is all true. And so they say, well, look, the power of the aristocracy. It's not in the Bible. You are telling me that God agrees with the power of the aristocracy and the power of the king. Look in the Bible. At the beginning, in this wonderful land with Adam and Eve, there was no aristocracy, and so you can see that radical religion is very, very terrifying for the elites at the time. Also, this group of people around John Ball, important group, lasted a few hundred years, they are called the Lollards. L-O-2-L-A-R-T-S, vous le trouverez sur Wikipedia. And they said, hey, look at Jesus in the Bible. Look at the apostles in the Bible. They are poor. Look at the bishop. Look at the archbishop and look at the king. They are rich. There's something wrong. Yeah? And so they said, if you really want to be religious, you cannot be rich. A very, very radical thing. They were against church corruption and so on. This is in the period when, of course, the church is building the cathedrals and so on and so forth. Finally, then, at the end of the period, is the... we're very lucky because the very famous book is written in 1386, and this is the Canterbury Tales, the Conte Canterbury, which are wonderful. Geoffrey Chaucer wrote them, and it is a sort of it's a sort c'est un peu le c'est le comment ça s'appelle les marionnettes à la télé où ils se montrent les ministres. Les guignols. C'est un peu les guignols de la foule de l'époque. Quoi. Okay? And so, a very, very harsh criticism. Ils ne savaient pas que c'était les guignols de la foule. Very, very harsh criticism of the system. Very harsh criticism, in particular, of the church. In his story, there is a prioress, donc la plus importante des bonnes sœurs dans le maire supérieur du couvent. And she was mostly interested in seducing men. Yes? And she showed how beautiful she was to seduce men. The monk, il y avait un moine, and he loved hunting. And he didn't like studying. Okay? And probably the best one is the friar, donc un autre type de moine, un frère, who, if you wanted confession, you give him some gold. Give him some gold. Oh, I absolve you. No problem. Yeah? Here I have a little quotation. A friar there was, a wanton and a merry, a limiter, a very festive one, man. In all the orders four is none that can equal his gossip and his fair langage. He has arranged full many a mariage of women young, and this at his own cost. Okay. Il y avait un frère qui aimait faire la fête. Dans tous les monastères, il n'y a aucun qui connaît autant les commérages que lui et qui parle aussi joliment que lui. En plus, il a organisé beaucoup de mariages de jeunes filles et c'est lui qui payait tous les frais. Alors, vous avez compris pourquoi il a organisé le mariage de jeunes filles et payé tous les frais. C'est très indirect, mais bon, on continue et c'est pas un gars très religieux, quoi. Pas très catholique, on pourrait dire. Okay, so this is a period when you begin to get very severe criticism of the church, and it's true that the church was really, the archbishops were extremely rich, and they lived extremely well, yet there were many good reasons to criticize the church in this period. And that's where I'm going to stop for today. Next week, we're going to look at the 15th, 16th, and 17th century, the Reformation, and the Civil War. Okay, thank you.